God is able to rescue you. That's the main message coming at us in the story of the flood here in chapters 6, 7, and 8 of Genesis. The situation that leads up to the flood is pretty straightforward. We've already talked about it today and even last week. It's that sin has gone rampant on the earth. We human sinners have violated the goodness of God's creation. Genesis 6, verses 11 and 13 say that the earth was filled with violence. Violence is the word, and that's not the way it's supposed to be. See, God's purpose for the earth is that it be filled with the knowledge of his glory. That's why he tells Adam and Eve in Genesis chapter 1 to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. The idea is that humans who bear God's image and who reflect God's glory, as they multiply throughout the entire earth, then the earth then will be filled with the knowledge of God's glory. That's the idea. But here in Genesis 6, we see something different. We see instead the carnage caused by sin. We see an earth not filled with the knowledge of God's glory, but instead we see an earth that's filled with violence. And therefore, God decides to wipe it out. He says he will destroy all flesh. The text says this very clearly in five different places. Chapter 6, verses 7, 13, and 17. Chapter 7, verses 4 and 22. God will blot out, wipe out every living thing that he has made from the face of the ground. Everything that is on the earth will die. God will destroy everything under heaven that has the breath of life. This is the kind of language you should describe the kind of destruction and judgment that God is going to bring upon the world. But the main message here is not judgment, it's salvation. The main point is that judgment is coming, God's bringing judgment, but Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. The Lord showed Noah grace. And so the most surprising thing in this story is not that God destroys every living thing on the earth. The most surprising thing in this story is that God spares Noah and his family from that destruction. Right away, we should just know this is not how we typically think. This is so different from how we're kind of programmed to see things. And this is one of the ways that the Bible always challenges us. Over and over again, the Bible comes and the Bible shows us that we need to reconfigure our questions. We tend to look at God's judgment on people and we ask, how could God do such a thing? Right? I get it. We read about God's judgment and we ask, how could God do such a thing? But see, really, that's the question we should ask of his mercy. It's not, how could God judge people? It should be, how could God save anyone? That's the right question that we should be asking, but it's a question that we're never going to get to unless we truly understand that God is bigger than us. And this is why Genesis 1:1 is so important. Again, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, which means that we did not make ourselves to be. God is bigger than us. God is sovereign over us. God can do what he wants. That's true. He's God. God can do what he wants. The most amazing thing is not that God judges sinners. The most amazing thing is that God rescues them. And that's actually the focus of the text. The focus of these three chapters is God's rescue. By the sheer mass of attention in Genesis 6, 7, and 8, the focus is about how God rescued Noah and his family. And that's what I want us to look at today. So for the sermon, I want to just show you three things in these chapters that we learn about God's rescue. Just three things, okay? Number one, I want to show you that God rescues those who trust him. All right, God rescues those who trust him. Number two, there is a future rescue yet to come. And then number three, I want you to know, it really is a rescue. It's a true, real, legit rescue. All right, so those three things. Let's start with the first one here. God rescues those who trust him. Okay, so God sends a flood and only Noah and his family are saved. We heard Sam read the text earlier. Every living thing dies except for Noah and those with him on the ark, right? So the question is, what's the big deal with Noah? Why is Noah and those with him rescued? What does this story tell us about Noah? Well, if we look at chapter 6, we see a string of descriptions about Noah. Verse 8 tells us first that Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. Aside from anything Noah has done, before we read anything about his character, we're told that God showed him grace. Grace means unmerited favor. Grace means undeserved goodness. And God showed that to Noah. It's the first time we see the word grace used in the Bible. And then second, in verse 9, we're told God showed Noah grace. Verse 8, verse 9, Noah was a righteous man. And again, the word righteous here is the first time this word is used in the Bible. And then right after that, we read the word blameless. Noah was a blameless man in his generation. Also the first time the word blameless is used in the Bible. And righteous and blameless carry the same meanings. It's the idea of innocence. And it's said here is meant to show a contrast between Noah and those around him. He's righteous. He's blameless. These first three descriptions of Noah, grace, righteous, blameless. These are all new words in the Bible. These are all the first time these words show up in the Bible. And in case we don't understand what these words mean, okay, in case we don't get what Moses is saying, there's a fourth and last description thrown in here at the end of verse 9. This is the fourth last description of Noah here. It reads, Noah walked with God, which is something we've seen before. Right, over in chapter 5, that's the exact same sentence that we read about Enoch. We read there in Genesis 5, verse 22, Enoch walked with God. And then here in chapter 6, we read, Noah walked with God. So we've seen this phrase before, and we're going to see this phrase again. Later on in Genesis chapter 17, God tells Abraham to walk before him. All right, so what does that mean? What does it mean to walk with God? Well, if we look here and we look later at Abraham and then we look at the faithful kings of Israel, we learn that to walk with God means to trust him. It means to have faith in him. To walk with God means to have faith in him. And one of the clearest ways that we know this is from the New Testament in Hebrews 11. The New Testament is always the best commentary on the Old Testament. And in Hebrews chapter 11, the writer there is talking about faith. And he lists several different people from the Old Testament who were keystone examples. These are keystone examples of what it means to have faith. And so he's mentioning all these men commending their faith. And in Hebrews 11, verse 5, he commends the faith of Enoch. He even says that Enoch's faith pleased God. All right, so you get this for a second. In Genesis 5, all we read is that Enoch walked with God. But in Hebrews 11, we read that Enoch's faith pleased God. Which means there's a connection between walking with God and having faith in God, right? And then who do you think is mentioned in Hebrews 11 right after Enoch? Hebrews 11, verse 7. By faith, Noah, being warned by God concerning events as yet unseen, in reverent fear constructed an ark for the saving of his household. By this, he condemned the world and became an heir of the righteousness that comes by faith. This is what the New Testament says about Noah. The story of Noah is the story of a man who trusted God. That's what it means to walk with God. It means to believe him. It means to trust him. And only then, when we trust God, will we do what God says. And this is an important point in the narrative. We see the obedience of Noah mentioned several times here, at least three times explicitly. It's implied all throughout. God tells Noah to do something, and the text says that Noah did exactly what God said. He says it this way. He did all that God commanded him. The text says that three times. The portrait here is of Noah waiting on God. Noah's looking to God, and Noah's faith is expressed through his listening to God. The emphasis in this story is not Noah's obedience in isolation. The emphasis is Noah's faith that is expressed through his obedience. Because you don't obey who you don't trust. Obedience is an action that flows from faith in the heart, and God is always concerned with the heart. We see this all throughout Scripture. God is concerned with the heart, not so much what you do. What you do is an expression, a flow over of what is in your heart. Let me give you an example of how we try to do this at home at the Parnell house. When I give my kids instructions, my kids are here. They know about this. We talked about this. They know this is coming up. All right. So when I give instruction at our house, when Melissa and I, my wife, when we give instruction, there are only two responses that are acceptable at our house. It's either okay or thank you, right? When our kids hear things that they like, we want them to be grateful. We want them to be thankful. So when we say, it goes like this, kids, have some chocolate brownie. And they say, thank you, right? So just like that, just say thank you. We want them to, they hear something they like, they want to be grateful, when they say thank you. Now, when our kids hear something like, okay, go clean your room. Okay. We want to hear that, just like that, just like that. Good job. That wasn't really choreographed that way, but exactly. We're working on this. We're working on this. But when we say, when it's chocolate brownies, just thank you. When it's clean your room, it's okay. We want our kids to trust us, right? But this is really good, guys. We're doing a good job. We're improving here. But most of the time, you want to guess what the comeback is when we say go clean your room? Anyone want to guess? Is why? That's the question, right? That's the response. Is why? See, when I hear instruction I don't like, rather than say okay and do it, we tend to question the instruction. And when we question instruction, that is not a heart of faith. That's not a heart of trust. And so we tell our kids, you can ask why. It is okay to ask why. But the first thing we want you to do is say okay, because we want you to trust us. We want you to trust us. We want you to know that everything we want to do for you is for your good. Everything that we say for you is for your good. Don't say why. Say okay, trust us. Trust that we have your good in mind here. We want what's best for you. It works the same way with God. Faith, trust, see, is the foundation of obedience. And that's what Noah is doing here. Noah is walking with God. Noah is trusting in God. Build an ark, Noah. Okay. Make it 300 cubits long, 50 cubits deep, and 30 cubits high, Noah. Okay. Bring with you every living thing, two of every living thing, bring it with you inside the ark, Noah. Okay. Noah does what God says because Noah trusts God. And this actually says more about God than it does to Noah. So we tend to admire Noah for his faith, and that's legit. I mean, Hebrews 11 commends him for his faith. But there's something else to consider in the passage. And it's not that Noah trusts God, it's that God is found to be so trustworthy. See, my sense is that if Noah were here, and I were talking to Noah, or even if he were to read Hebrews 11, right? And we would say, Noah, bro, your faith is so encouraging. Your faith is it's so helpful to me. I wish I had faith like you. I think Noah would say to us, are you kidding me? God said he was going to destroy the entire earth. And he told me to build a boat. What do you think I would do, right? We are enamored by Noah's faith, but Noah is saying, what do you mean? I think he would say, God said he's wiping out the entire world with a flood, and he told me to build a boat. Of course I'm going to build a boat. Noah didn't just say, okay. He said, thank you, when God gave him these instructions. See, if we keep pressing in here, we learn that Noah's faith says more about God than it does him. What is it about this God and the word of this God that causes Noah to stop what he's doing one day and restructure his entire life around what this God says? That's what's happening here. That's the wonder here. It's that Noah knew what we so desperately need to know, that God is trustworthy. When he says things, we should listen. You can lean on God. You can rest in God. God rescues those who trust him. And that's good for us to know because there's a flood coming. There's a flood coming. A flood came here in Genesis 6, 7, and 8. And there's a future flood yet to go. So yet to come. So we got number one here. Now we're number two. There's a future flood, a future rescue yet to come. One of the things we see in this story is that God's judgment and salvation in the flood become, here's the word for you, typological. All right. What it means is this, is that what God does here in the flood, in judgment and salvation here, it becomes a type of things that God will do again. And we see this all throughout the Bible. The flood sort of becomes a pattern for how God works. And this text shows us this a few different ways. Let me just give you one. Okay, this is chapter 8, verse 1. The end of chapter 8, verse 1 says this, quote, "And God made a wind blow over the earth, and the water subsided." Now, I think there's a connection in this verse that goes back to Genesis 1, when the Spirit hovered over the face of the waters. The word for spirit and wind are the same in Hebrew. But I think this also has a connection into the future. And this is in the book of Exodus. Okay, so in the book of Exodus, which is the book of the Bible that comes right after the book of Genesis, this is later on in the biblical storyline, the people of Israel, they've been slaves in Egypt for several years, and God comes to his people to set them free. All right, so God sends judgment upon the Egyptians, and he leads his people Israel free out of Egypt until they come to the Red Sea. So all these people come out, they come out of Egypt, they come to the Red Sea, and Egypt is coming behind them. An army of the Egyptians is behind them, I mean, making headway, coming right up on their heels, and they're stuck. They have nowhere to go. There's a huge sea right in front of them. And so what is going to happen? Hannah actually wrote a song about this. We're going to maybe sing it for you one day. It's called "God Made a Way When There Was No Way," because that's what he did here. They come to this sea. There's no way to get through, but this is what the Bible says in Exodus 14, 21. "Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord drove the sea back by a strong east wind all night and made the sea dry land, and the waters were divided." So just like in Genesis 8, when God used a wind to blow over the waters and make them subside, he uses a wind here in Exodus 14 to blow over the waters and divide the Red Sea. And in both Genesis 8 and Exodus 14, there's this mention of dry ground, the exact phrase there. In both cases, God sends a wind to make the ground dry where there used to be water. And in both cases, this meant judgment for some and salvation for others. Only Noah and his family walked on the dry ground after the flood. Everyone else was destroyed by the water. Only Israel walked on the dry ground through the Red Sea. The Egyptians were all destroyed by the water. See, Moses, who wrote about both of these events, he wants us to see a connection between the two. And the principle here is that God's work in the past prefigures his work in the present and in the future. God's judgment and rescue in the flood is a type that points to a greater ultimate judgment and rescue yet to come. And there are prophetic echoes of this judgment and rescue all throughout the Bible. The Exodus of Israel here, the parting of the Red Sea, this is just an echo of the flood that still points to a greater ultimate judgment and rescue that's to come. And the greater ultimate judgment and rescue that's to come is what Jesus tells us about in the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 24. Okay, this is Matthew's the first book of the New Testament, and Jesus is teaching here, and this is what he tells us in Matthew 24, 37. He says, "For as were the days of Noah, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. For as in those days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage until the day when Noah entered the ark, and they were unaware until the flood came and swept them all away, so will be the coming of the Son of Man." So Jesus here In his teaching, he draws a parallel between what happened in the flood and what will happen when he returns. Jesus is the Son of Man. He's the Son of Man. And one day he's going to come back to the earth. And when he comes back, when Jesus comes back, it's going to mean judgment, just like it did when God sent the flood. That's what he's saying. Jesus makes his connection to the story of Noah, and the apostles actually pick up on it later. Later on, the apostle Peter, in actually two of his letters, he makes the same connection that Jesus does. In 2 Peter chapter 3, Peter says that the world that used to exist was, here it is, quote, verse 6, deluged with water and perished. That's what Peter says. He's talking about the flood, all right? And then he says that the heavens and the earth that now exist are being stored up for fire, being kept until the day of judgment and the destruction of the ungodly. So Peter says that the world that used to exist was judged by water, and now the world that exists will be judged in a similar way, except this time it's going to be by fire. Old world, judged by water. This world will be judged by fire, which is serious, right? He's talking about this world. He's talking about the world we live in. That's what Peter's talking about, the world that we live in and work in and do our life in. This is the world he's talking about, which is a big deal. The judgment of God is a serious thing. And it's so easy for us to read verses like this and just write it off. Man, we're modern people. You know, we try to poetically tiptoe around words like this, or we try to think that maybe Peter was exaggerating, you know. It's funny how this goes for us. A lot of times when we come across things that we don't like, we assume that it's someone else's problem. That's how it works. Right? When you encounter things we don't like, it must be someone else's problem. We're predisposed here to read Peter's words about judgment and think that he is the crazy one. But here's the twist. You ready for the twist? Peter's not the crazy one. We are. Anytime we read something in the Bible that seems crazy, the Bible is not the crazy one. We are. And the alarm clock keeps going off. The alarm clock keeps sounding. It keeps trying to wake us up, but we just hit the snooze over and over again. We just try to ignore it. We try to plug our ears. We'd rather sleep a little longer than open our eyes to the mess that we've made of this world. We would rather drug ourselves with distraction than sober up to the reality that we have filled this earth with violence. The writing is on the wall. Just look around. We have filled the earth with violence. That's what Peter's saying here. We have filled the earth with violence. The ultimate judgment is coming. It's coming. But it's not just judgment that will come. It's also rescue. And it really is a rescue. It really is a rescue, okay? So judgment's coming. That's what Peter's saying. Judgment, ultimate judgment, real judgment is coming. And there's also a rescue that's going to come. The Apostle Peter makes another connection to the flood in another one of his letters, this time in 1 Peter chapter 3. This is also in the New Testament. Peter has told us, as Jesus himself says in Matthew 24, that a future judgment is coming when Jesus returns, okay? And here in 1 Peter 3, he makes the connection to the salvation of Noah, all right? Judgment's coming, now the salvation of Noah. This is kind of a clunky section of verses, but what Peter's saying here in verse 20 in chapter 3, verse 21, is about the salvation. Let me read it to you, and I'll try to untangle some of it here. This is 1 Peter 3:20. So while the ark was being prepared, a few, that is eight persons, is Noah and his family, eight people, were brought safely through water. Baptism which corresponds to this, now saves you, not as a removal of dirt from the body, but as an appeal to God for a good conscience through the resurrection of Jesus Christ. So when Peter says baptism here, this is why it's kind of clunky. When Peter says baptism here, he's not talking about the act of being dunked underwater, all right? He's not saying that literally being dunked underwater saves you. And he clarifies it right away in the verse. He adds there, not as a removal of dirt from the body, meaning he's saying, I'm not talking about the physical act of being baptized. Instead, Peter says, I'm talking about the appeal to God for a good conscience through the resurrection of Jesus Christ. In other words, Peter is saying we're saved when we identify our lives with Jesus by faith. We're saved when we're rescued. We're saved when we appeal to God for the rescue we need. When we say to God, I'm with Jesus. Peter means the same thing here that the Apostle Paul means in Romans chapter 6. When Paul says in Romans 6 that when we're baptized into Christ Jesus, we are spiritually united with him, which means that when we put our faith in Jesus, we are so associated with Jesus, we so identify with Jesus that spiritually his death becomes our death and his resurrection becomes our resurrection, spiritually. That's what Paul says in Romans 6. It's the same thing that Peter is saying here. The point is this. The point here is that just as Noah was saved amid the waters of judgment by the ark, we can be saved amid the coming judgment by Jesus. Because Jesus is our ark. That's what Peter's saying. That's what it means to trust in Jesus. It means that we say, when the flood is coming, when the dam of God's judgment is about to break loose, we say, Jesus is my ark. I'm in his boat. He's my ark. Jesus, only Jesus can accomplish the rescue that we need. And we all know deep down that we need a rescue. We all know this. We all know deep down we need to be rescued. Maybe we've not thought about the coming judgment of this world. Maybe we've not considered that much, but we all know at least, at the very least, that something's broken around us. There's something broken in the world. There's something broken in us. Something is off. We know that. We all know deep down we need to be rescued. So how does it work? How does the rescue work? It goes like this. Jesus is able to rescue you because he took the divine judgment that you deserved. This is the gospel. What happened when Jesus died on the cross is that he took all of our sin, all of our guilt, all of our shame, he took it on the cross, and in our place, he suffered the judgment that we deserved. The flood was coming for us. And Jesus took it in our place. The flood waters were barreling toward us in judgment. And Jesus drank them all down. He drank it all. He took the judgment coming for us. He took the judgment for us in our place if we trust him. If we get in his ark. That's what faith is. Faith is saying from the heart, I'm with Jesus. Jesus is my ark. And one of the ways that we remember this is at the table. And so what I want to do for just a moment as the band and the pastors will come prepare the cup, I want us just to spend a moment to reflect upon the rescue of Jesus. I want us to spend a moment here just in silence and prayer and thanks about the rescue that Jesus has accomplished for us. So just to spend a moment in prayer and reflection about Jesus taking the judgment in your place. Let's just pray together now. So at the table, the bread represents the broken body of Jesus and the cup represents the blood of Jesus. And when we eat the bread and we drink the cup by faith, we remind ourselves and we remind one another that we're with Jesus. We take the bread and we take the cup and we are reminded that we are in his ark. And so I want to go ahead and serve you now. The bread, which is his body, represents his body. If Jesus is your ark, we want to invite you to eat with us. We'll serve the bread now.